Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Going to talk about white bark pine. This is a photograph of a white bark pine forest. White bark pine are the highest elevation forests on the continent. They're found in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem at elevations around 9,000 feet, right up to and above timberline as Krumholz Forest. They're essentially all old growth forest. That's not an economically important species, but as we'll see, it's ecologically quite important. This is a shot of a white bark pine forest taken by Thomas Turiano, and essentially a before and after shot. I hope that's dark enough in here to see the red in this after shot, essentially the same photograph, or same perspective, just a couple of years later. And it's no accident that these were taken by Thomas Turiano, the premier alpinist in the greater Yellowstone, because I say these are really the high elevation forests. And so the question is, these red trees in these high forests killed by mountain pine beetle, and the basic ecological question is this something that's a normal course of events, or is this really unusual in the ecological history of white bark pine? So these trees, those red trees, were killed in one summer by this organism, the mountain pine beetle. This audience is a bit different than most audiences I talk to about this issue, in that I'm probably the only person that will be in the room that's really interested in this organism in and of itself. You know, it's a nondescript little beetle. It's not so much what the mountain pine beetle is as what it does. This is a shot taken in Glacier National Park in the late 1970s. And the mountain pine beetle is a bit unusual for an insect in that it's a true predator that has to kill its host to successfully reproduce, and occasionally it does so in large numbers, as you can see in this slide. Mountain pine beetle is also a native insect, probably moved north as pines colonized western North America. So it's been around a long time, and these outbreak events occur periodically. This is lodgepole pine forest, and in fact these sorts of disturbances are really important in the ecology of lodgepole pine. It's a disturbance regenerated or disturbance maintained species over much of its distribution. So mountain pine beetle, native insect, historically reaches these massive populations, resulting in significant mortality, particularly in lodgepole and ponderosa pine. But something very different has started to happen in these high elevation forests. And it's very much a result of what's going on, what we're doing to the climate. This is the only slide I'm going to talk about climate change, but probably everybody in the room is familiar with the hockey-shaped curves of greenhouse gases and the associated increase in temperature that has gone along with it. And temperature has two major impacts on the life history of the mountain pine beetle, or the life cycle of the mountain pine beetle. First of all, and pretty directly, winter temperatures need to be mild enough so there's significant survival over winter. And in these high elevation forests where white bark pine occurs, historically, temperatures have just been too cold. A mountain pine beetle is quite resistant to cold temperatures, but at these high elevations, minus 40 degrees C, or Fahrenheit actually, have historically not been uncommon, and at those temperatures, mortality is quite significant. And secondly, there needs to be enough heat increment in the summer to complete a life cycle in 1 year. And that's also really important for maintaining these outbreak populations. So temperature has two very clear and important impacts on the life cycle of the beetle. Based on the importance and the recognized importance of temperature in the life cycle of the beetle, really beginning back in the 1970s, we were developing models that related temperature to the life history of the mountain pine beetle. So we had the machinery in place at the time the first IPCC report came out with global warming in 1990. So we had the machinery to ask the question, and so we did. And we developed models like this that projected if the predictions from the climate models were true, what might happen with mountain pine beetle? And this is a model of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, roughly, and the red is the distribution of white bark pine that we predicted with a worst case scenario, what might happen with the movement of this native insect into new habitats, essentially new habitats. And so we came up with these risk maps in the 1990s, projecting what could happen if the scenarios were in fact realized. And one thing that has been borne out in history from our earlier predictions with these models is our worst case scenarios weren't bad enough. Actually, the greenhouse gas accumulations have been greater than the business as usual projections back in the early days of climate change scenarios. But anyway, we were coming up with maps that looked like this, and just as an added point of interest, the yellow line there is the core area for grizzly bear recovery, and the reason for that, the importance of that, will become clear in just a minute. So what has happened? The upper left-hand figure here happens to be a tourist photograph I got off the web. It's a place near the east entrance of Yellowstone National Park, Hoyt Peak, very near a place called Avalanche Peak. And this photograph was taken in the late 1990s, could have been taken in 2001. But you can see the green white bark pine forest. A friend of mine in 2004 took a photograph almost from the same perspective. These red trees have been killed in the previous summer by mountain pine beetle. These gray trees probably 2 years before, but you can see this forest has largely been eliminated by a mountain pine beetle outbreak. I was near the same area about this time last year, looking down on a white bark pine forest, and superficially this looked like a fire. But it's no fire. It's the fire that doesn't go out. It recurs year after year. And essentially, if you go down in this forest, which was a conifer forest, you could see that all trees above about 6 inches in diameter have been killed by the mountain pine beetle. So this is sort of the epicenter where things first really became noticeable, because it's very near Dunraven Pass, a major road. But widespread throughout the Yellowstone ecosystem, scenes like this are very common indeed. Again, the red trees killed the previous summer, the gray trees in years previously. So it's a widespread occurrence. Probably 80% of the white bark pine in the Greater Yellowstone will be lost in the next few years. And it's happened very suddenly and unexpectedly. There was a report by the USGS at the turn of the century, sort of a stock of biological resources in the United States at the millennial. The article on white bark pine, Kate Kendall wrote, and in this article, not only are bark beetles not mentioned, but surely the mountain pine beetle is not mentioned. By 2008, this year, a report came out, stand evaluations in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem with mortality levels in excess of 90% of the trees killed. So it's really was an unexpected event. As I say, we had some theoretical indications that it was a possibility, but no one, including myself, had any expectation it would occur so suddenly or so dramatically. And we're finally understanding some of the reasons why. Most of what we know about the mountain pine beetle comes from either lodgepole or ponderosa pine, and white bark pine is a very different species indeed. And speaking of white bark, they're really the rooftop of the continent, of the northern Rockies, these high elevation forests. They're quite important ecologically. As I mentioned, they're not of timber value, but the ecological amenities are really critical to how that northern ecosystem functions. The upper hand left, we can see this group of elk moving into a white bark pine forest. That's usually the view I have of elk during hunting season, far off moving into cover. But white bark pine provides the really the only cover in these high elevation systems, not only cover from predator, but thermal regulation in the summer. Immensely important in wildlife, perhaps even more critical for the concerns of humans, is the impact and the importance of these high elevation forests on both the accumulation and distribution of snow in the winter. Almost all water in the West is from snow melt and accumulated high elevation systems, and also the attenuation of snow melt in spring. You can see in this lodgepole pine forest where you have forest cover, there's still snow on the ground. The open areas, the exposed areas, the snow is melted. So it really impacts the release of water, which is critical for human use downstream. So these high elevation systems, the importance of these systems are felt all the way from the mountaintops to the valley bottoms. They're tremendously important. And one illustration of that I'll use is the grizzly bear, very direct connection from a small beetle to an iconic species of the Yellowstone ecosystem and of the continent in general. How is a beetle connected to a grizzly bear? Well, the whitebark pine seeds are highly nutritious. They're really an important food resource for many animals, but red squirrels collect large numbers of cones and store them on the ground in middens. And of course, a red squirrel is very little threat to a grizzly bear. The grizzlies raid these squirrel middens in large numbers, and in fact, it's the critical food resource for grizzly bears at this time of year when they're starting to den up in their hyperphagia, when they're going into this eating phase. And in fact, if females don't get enough nutrition, then they will abort fetus. And in the greater Yellowstone, there's a paucity of other food. So in the fall, whitebark pine is really the only thing that's available, or the largely available, and there's a very clear relationship between population growth of grizzly bears and availability of whitebark pine. Years with good seed crops, you can see an increase in the reproductive potential. Years with a poor seed crop, there's actually a negative reproductive potential. So they very directly felt in the population growth, and maybe even more importantly, in years with good seed production, grizzly bears are up in the high country. These are really the most remote forests on the continent, so they're out of harm's way. In years with poor seed production, the grizzly bears get down into things like garbage, and they're kicking around in places like Jackson and Du Bois. So there's a very clear relationship between the number of human bear conflicts with cone production. And this is a graph of trapping, but it translates very directly into the death rate of adult females. And one of the predictions, again, is with the loss of whitebark pine, the grizzlies will no longer be held in these high elevation environments, be moving down where there are people. The grizzly has been delisted for 2 years. Last year, there was one mortality short of the threshold for the interagency grizzly bear study team to reinitiate considering this issue. This year, that mortality rate has been blown by. There have been over 70 mortalities of grizzlies this year just in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So that's an indication of how these things reverberate and cycle through an ecosystem. So the question is, it's pretty clear that something important is going on in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and a lot of other places, really the distribution of whitebark pine. Amazing and important things are happening, but still there is a question, in some sort of ecological context, is this really an important issue or not? And it relates very directly to some basic ecological issues like the historic range variability. If you do a Google search on historic range variability in quotation marks, you'll come up with about 3,000 hits. So, you know, this is a pretty basic question, and particularly in disturbance ecology. When something like this occurs, it's obvious on the landscape, but is it really of ecological importance, or is it something that's unusual in an ecological sense with the sorts of ramifications that that come from a disturbance event like this? And so this is the issue really that I want to address today. First of all, it's not unheard of. This is a quote back in 1934. Chief Ranger Bagley, shown in the photograph here, but the quote is, practically every stand of white bark is heavily infested and will be swept clean in a few years. And I think in a few years is really the important key to this statement. There was widespread mortality in whitebark pine in the mid-30s, but What we see now is something very different, both in magnitude and intensity, because white bark pine is a very slow growing species. The legacy of mortality that we're seeing today will be apparent on the landscape for centuries, really. And that legacy is not here. So, you know, there was significant mortality, but the thing that's really different, if you look at the temperatures in the 30s, there was some warm. There was a warm period, and in particular, the winter of 33-34 was the warmest on record. But temperatures very soon came back to more typical historical average. What we're seeing now is something very different. And in fact, when you look at the expression of global warming is exactly that. It's a global phenomenon, but it's expressed regionally. And the Western United States is one of the area that's warming the fastest within the United States, outside of Alaska, outside of the Arctic, and in fact is one of the fastest warming areas on the continent. So warming is occurring in the West at a regional rate that's higher than the global average, and that's expressed in this graph and the trend line. So what we had in the 30s was a very short pulse of warm temperatures. What we're having now is a trend. So we go back to Bagley's comment about if conditions remain the same. Also, there are theoretical grounds. And theoretical in the population ecology, based primarily on Locavoltaire type arguments, it's almost impossible for a predator to drive a prey to extinction. But these are really based on either two populations or small community sort of food web theory. And of course, ecosystems in nature are embedded in much larger systems. Clark's nutcracker, the bird here, is almost totally responsible for the reproductive strategy of white bark pine. They cache large numbers of seeds, and the almost all reproduction in white bark is related to residual caches of Clark's nutcracker. So the tree is almost totally dependent on Clark's nutcracker. The nutcracker itself, however, is much more an opportunistic. There are a lot of good food resources. So the question I ask is, 80 years from now, when there is some regeneration in white bark pine, it takes that long before they start bearing cones, will Clark's nutcracker come back essentially to white bark pine forest? And I don't know the answer to that. I have no crystal ball, but I think it's a legitimate question to ask for sure. So there are other things going on. Large, just the scale of the disturbance. We had a good natural experiment in 1988 with the Yellowstone fires. If you go back in Yellowstone now, every place there was a lodgepole forest, there's a nice understory. A few large white bark pine stands burned, you go into those stands, and there's essentially no understory. It's because the area is too large to be economic for the Clark's nutcracker to come back into these large scale disturbances. They're very effective at small scale disturbances, but not large scale. So there's just the scale. There's also the impact over much of the West. You'll find lower elevation pine forest. There'll be a mid-elevation of spruce fir, and then finally the white bark in the high country. So you get a very definite zonation with a non-host buffer between lodgepole and white bark. And you get temperature having that impact of separating them as well. But within most of the greater Yellowstone, there's large edaphic climax white bark lodgepole forest that intergrade directly into the white bark. And you can see the white bark here is really getting clobbered by the beetles. So there's a reservoir that's going to be maintained in lodgepole ready to move into any regeneration that occurs. So my assessment of this is, in the short term, there's really a critical issue with things like grizzly bears. But in the long term, there's also a question of the actual survival on the landscape and the ecological functionality of white bark pine due to what's going on. My friend Louisa Wilcox here is standing by beside a large white bark. White bark's very slow growing, so you see a tree this large, it's pretty amazing. John Muir was astounded to find in the Sierras, he cut down and did a tree ring count of a white bark pine, 6 inches in diameter, it was 426 years old. So you see a tree this large, this is a 1,000-year-old tree at least. It's withstood everything that nature could throw at it. This is a lightning strike, you know, everything but what we've done. If you look around the bottom, you can see the frass of the indication that it's been successfully attacked by mountain pine beetle. There was a good cone crop this year on this tree, but it's the last harvest in at least a millennia, and this is going on throughout the ecosystem. So what we have, I think, is very much a situation of a native invasive species. Through our actions with what we have and how we've altered climate, we have allowed the occupation of a new habitat by a native species with some pretty devastating consequences. And I think as things begin to play out with global warming, this will become increasingly common tale. Thank you.
Any questions for Jesse?
You know, it's really difficult to hear up here. My hearing's not that great. I heard the question was about white bark, but that's about it. I'm sorry. Yes, you know, my interpretation would be there was a cluster of pretty warm years there, and rather than looking back at that and saying, well, this is just situation normal, it should have been a real warning for us. But, you know, there was very little recognition or white bark pine, mountain pine beetle just had not played a role there, and I think it was a release. Populations are in those high elevation ecosystems at very low levels. We started working in white bark in the early 90s before all this started to happen, and after a few years we were able to find places where we could find mountain pine beetle in these high elevation systems. They've been there, but things like the 33-34 event and other warm spells will release a pulse in place. They're not invading, in my opinion. So that's exactly the right interpretation. My estimate on the surviving population, primarily size, is trees that are too small for the mountain pine beetle to successfully, but there is hope as well. There's some really interesting things going on. One is that that really is exciting to me. Apparently, white bark pine is just not defended, and nearly in the same sense as lodgepole or ponderosa, simply because, again, in my interpretation, that there just hasn't been this coevolutionary relationship. But this spring I was skiing up behind my house looking at white bark, looking at trees that have been killed last summer, the previous summer, 2007, and interested in overwintered survival. And so I go along and the trees are still green, but they have a characteristic, you know what to look for, and they're always dead. We're hacking in with a hatchet, you know, looking at survival. And I hit this one tree, whoa, this is living phloem. It was a tree that had very clearly exhibited the secondary or induced response. So it does exist in the gene pool. What we really, I think the most critical research need is to get people like Ken Raffa, who really understand what's going on in issues of resistance, to get serious about white bark pine, because there is potential, and I think it's really an exciting potential. So. Hey, Dave.
How the southern distributed white bark pine forest faring? More southern distributed mountain pine.
It's interesting because we are working in the Rockies, at least in the southern distribution of white bark pine, and it's interesting that the truly majestic white bark pine forests are at the southern part of the distribution of white bark pine in the Rockies. So we are working in these beautiful climax white bark pine forests. And they're the ones that are absolutely getting clobbered. So, you know, it seems at least through the southern, which is the northern Rockies distribution that I'm familiar with, north-south doesn't seem to make much impact. There are local areas like the core of the Wind River Mountains, really cold glacial impacts, and the core of the winds are still Climax, beautiful white bark pine. If you go up onto the Beartooth Plateau, the largest contiguous area above 10,000 feet in the U.S., once again, the white bark pine forests are healthy there, and it's really encouraging because it's a huge plateau rather than a cone-shaped mountain of Krumholz, which has the potential to produce cone, assume an upright form. So there are specific areas, but it's not so much north-south that I can see. East-west, in the ecosystem, you tend to have a general increase in elevation west to east. The eastern part is not as heavily impacted. So it's local sorts of things like that I see, Dave.
Sierra population suffering?
Can't answer. After I retired, I moved to this really little isolated place in Montana, and I don't see much beyond what's outside my window. So I really can't address the issue in the Sierras.
I understand there is strong mortality in the Sierra.
That's, yeah. Because there's probably not these vast climax forests of white bark pine in the Sierras, much, much richer, more heterogeneous forest.
Do you know anything about the survivorship of the next crop that comes up, or seedlings?
Yeah, this is an interesting story as well, and there's some mountain pine beetle is not going to hit these trees until they're up around 6 to 7 inches in white bark pine, which is a little smaller typically than we think of in lodgepole. So the recruitment, the little trees are going to be safe, and they're a very slow growing tree. In the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, take typically at least 80 years to reach cone bearing age and size. So that's about, these trees are not going to be hit for 80 years if they're just seedlings right now. I was in a really interesting situation this fall. I was in a small, like 10, 15 acre lightning strike fire. So it was an even aged little stand of white bark pine. Probably occurred 80 years ago, so there are just a few trees starting to be in cone-bearing age. Every tree I could find that was above about 7 inches had been killed by mountain pine beetle. The little ones were still there, but they were taking them out just as soon as they reached that sort of cone-bearing size and age. But we got some time because of the slow growth of the white bark pine. Some areas with good recruitment, there's going to be an understory coming up. A lot of, in some areas where there's not, like that one photograph was taken white bark is not going to come back there for a long time, if ever.
Any other questions for Jesse?
Is there any management strategy for these types of beetles? I mean, like southern pine beetles, there's a lot of beetles out there that are big problems. What's the management strategy for them? If we could do something, what should it be?
Well, yeah, there are management things going on, and I didn't quite fully answer this issue about size of white bark pine and thyme. Not only the little guys are King's X from white bark pine, but there's an introduced pathogen. White pine blister rust was introduced the turn of the previous century, and trees that are infected with white pine blister rust are predisposed to mountain pine beetle. They're more attractive to the beetle. And the little trees are clearly susceptible to white pine blister rust. So blister rust is an issue, and it is related to the bark beetle, subsequent mortality by bark beetle. Blister rust has a complex life cycle, and there are critical times in this life cycle where low moisture inhibits the spread of blister rust. So as you move north in the distribution of white bark pine, it's more of an issue than it is down where we are in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. It occurs there, but in much lower concentrations than, say, up in Canada. So there are management strategies. One is white pine blister rust, because it's slower acting, there has been an active program to collect resistant seeds and actual plantation of resistant white pine blister rust. And one management strategy utilizing our modeling approach is don't do it in areas that we're predicting high risk. You know, look at, use some insight and find areas that have lower risk for mountain pine beetle to plant blister rust resistant trees. You don't want a plantation that 80 years from now is going to be taken out by mountain pine beetles. So management strategies like that. There are some management strategies like trying to, there's always been this balance between subalpine fir and white bark pine, and there is some vegetation management to remove subalpine fir to open up opportunities for white bark pine. But in my opinion, you better be really cautious about this because you might be cutting down the only forest that's going to be there 80 years from now. So, you know, there are things like that. And I think we can focus issues on our research, particularly in areas like the Beartooth Plateau and the Wind River Mountains for resistance work. We could, you know, begin to really understand the resistance, the chemistry that's going on in white bark pine. We may be able to do a similar sort of thing as blister rust. So I think a long-term strategy, there is that as well. And as a society, as a global society, we can begin to address the issue of global warming. That's what's driving this. And so we need to get serious about things like that.
Do you think there's any potential for using the anti-aggregation pheromone for herbinol to slow the spread?
It's being widely used in white bark pine, and you may get, we've got world's experts here, and I'm not in the audience who could better answer that question. In my opinion, there is some interesting things that can be done with verbenone, but the whole history of verbenone with mountain pine beetle has been checkered, and I don't think there is a hope for altering the course of events for things that are set in motion using the pheromones, but there could be differences in opinion.
All right. Thanks again, Jesse.